Right, and I think that's it. Over to Yuan speaking on the meaning of life.
Many millions of years ago, a race of hyper-intelligent, pan-dimensional beings got so fed up with the constant bickering about the meaning of life that they commissioned two of their brightest and best to design and build a stupendous supercomputer to calculate the answer to life, the universe, and everything.
Oh, Deep Thought, we want you to tell us the answer.
The answer to what?
The answer to life, the universe, everything.
We'd really like an answer. Something simple.
I have to think about that. Return to this place in exactly 7.5 million years.
Is it finished? Oh, no, there's more.
They go back.
What, 7.5 million years later?
That's right. They do.
An answer for you? Yes, but you're not going to like it.
It doesn't matter. We must know it.
All right. The answer to the ultimate question of life, the universe, and everything is... ...42.
As a matter of fact, if you go online and you Google what is the meaning of life, what is the answer to the meaning of life and everything, just a normal Google search, it brings up a calculator and it says 42. No jokes. I actually tried to get the screenshot, but my electronic capabilities only allowed me to put on the meaning of life in the PowerPoint. But That's Douglas Adams' version of the meaning of life, about 42. Now, it's a bit of a cliche to talk about the meaning of life because a lot of people take a jab at it. There was a Monty Python movie not long ago called The Meaning of Life. Did anybody see that movie, The Meaning of Life? Well, that's why you guys are at the talk, because you're still searching. Now, it's a bit of a cliche to talk about the meaning of life. There are usually these sketches where guys walk on campus and just randomly walk up to people and ask them what's the meaning of life. But there's a reason why we constantly ask this question. And in the beginning of the year, when we still have a little bit of perspective, we tend to ask questions like, what is the meaning of life? If I do this talk in 2 or 3 months' time, chances are you're going to punch me, because by then you will be so drawn into life that you do not have time to think about the meaning of life. Now, recently I received a call from a girl in the Tembisa program called Tsetso. You're probably not supposed to have your favorites, but I'm afraid I do. And Tsetso phoned me and she said, I just want to thank you and the Dialoog team for everything you've done. I've passed matric, I've got matric exemption, and I'm going to UJ. And we are at the moment working to get a scholarship there. Luckily, we've got André van Sale, whom we've abused a couple of times to speak here at Dialoog, and who coincidentally also works in the education department at UJ. So we're just going to pass that one on to him. And when she told me this, I was so excited, and I felt... It felt meaningful, right? If you hear a message like that, it feels as if life and what we do over here has meaning. And then this morning, for no apparent reason, it was so stupid and so unnecessary, my new phone, I've been struggling with the phone, my new phone fell in the toilet. just randomly. It wasn't... It was so unnecessary. It was a little bit like the school bully who takes your lunch and he doesn't eat it himself. He just throws it in the dustbin. That's a meaningless exercise, right? And it felt a little bit like that. I mean, it was, and then obviously I need to reach in and get the phone. And, well, the story is I've got a phone in the bowl of rice, which apparently works because Asians come at night to fix your phone. But in that moment, it just felt incredibly meaningless. Now, that's a lighthearted example, I guess. But there are certain things that when we ponder about them, it's impossible to think that there's some bigger purpose lying behind it. So Rob Bell did that series not long ago called Everything is Spiritual. Now, not a lot of you guys saw The Meaning of Life, but I assume a lot of you saw Rob Bell's Everything is Spiritual. Okay, there's a couple of nods. And he obviously never captured data, just capturing data into a computer, taking that piece of information, putting it over there, taking that information, putting it over there. And after a whole day of data capturing, your computer crashes. Now, when that happens to you, and this happens to people, then it's impossible to say everything is spiritual. It's impossible to have this nice music and to speak in this hipster, sexy voice and to think everything is spiritual when you are confronted with data capturing. It's a little bit of a modern-day version of Sisyphus. You know about the Greek myth Sisyphus, the guy, apparently he leaked information to the humans and he was condemned to always push a rock up a mountain. And as soon as he reached the summit, the gods would just push it down again. And he would walk down and push it up. And sometimes life feel like that. And probably the best example that I could get is the issue of data capturing or any sort of work that we've done on computers and then the computer crashes. Now, when you observe a baby, just to push this point home, when you observe a baby, we've got Leah over there playing on a very unhygienic floor, and when we look at Leah, there's not a lot of babies here, so when we have one, there's a lot of attention. And when you count the fingers, even if you're not the mother or the father, there's something special about it. And you think, there's meaning in this little human being. There's so much purpose in this little human being. And you get excited and you philosophize over life and you are certain that there's something behind it. And then when we read, and this happens on a regular basis, of a toddler just, I don't know, running and exploring the house or the playground and falling, bumping his or her head and dying, then the meaning that I just described turns into such arbitrariness. It doesn't make any sense. It's so unnecessary for a toddler to die in such a silly manner. And that's the difficult tightrope that we are in this life, to decide how can this one thing be meaningful? And sometimes we experience something that is just utterly arbitrary and meaningless. Now, with that introduction, let me say this. There's one thing that this question at least illustrates. It is a uniquely human question. I don't know of any other species that asks this question, what is the meaning of life? So very seldom do you find a chicken contemplating, being self-aware, what am I here for? I mean, I can see that there's a piece of corn or nut over there, but why eat it? Why go through this mundane exercise every day? And we can laugh at chickens, but even chimpanzees that we regard as very intelligent, even they are not self-aware. I'm sure a couple of people will argue this, but they don't ask this question, what is the meaning of life? So it's something that is peculiar and unique to humans, this introspective nature of us. And I think there's a clue in that as well. But let's park that there for a moment. We are always desperate for answers as human beings, especially in a place like Dialuag. A lot of critical thinking happens here. So when we talk about prayer, then what I get back is why? Why pray? Why is it necessary to pray? I'm imagining there's something very entertaining happening behind me. So when we talk about prayer, that's okay if they're not going to fall off. Why pray? You would ask. And if I say, listen, guys, it's important for us to do this, you want reasons. Why is it important for us to do that? And that's not only a dialogue thing, that's a human thing. We ask those type of questions. But what I find very interesting is the fact that we ask a reason for almost everything. If I tell you, please meet me tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock, at the corner of Solomon Moshlangu and, now I need to find something that crosses with it, and Gashfontein, then you're going to ask me the question, why? Why meet me there? Why, what's happening there? And that's a valid question. It's a reasonable question. But if we want reasons for everything in life, all the little things, then certainly we need a reason for the big thing, for life itself. Am I right? If we want a reason, if we want purpose, an explanation for all these little things, then surely we need to have an explanation for life itself. Now, there are people who approach this question in a number of different ways. And now, I'm not going to be able to do all of these views justice, but at least from a superficial perspective, if you look at the Eastern worldview and how they deal with it, the Eastern worldview would say that if, in response to this question, what is the meaning of life, they would probably say that it is a nonsensical question. It is the wrong question. They would refuse to answer the question because to look for meaning is the problem in the first place. It's an illusion. And in response to death, they would probably say that death is not the problem. It's the coming back part that's the problem. It's the reincarnation bit that's the problem. And we need to reach a state where we can escape this cycle, this vicious cycle of reincarnation. So for them, the question, what is the meaning of life, is a nonsensical question and an illusion. What about the secularist worldview? Their response would be DIY, do it yourself. You create your own meaning. So in preparation for tonight, I YouTube the meaning of life, and there are so many videos that they put together with, I don't know, nice voices and celebrities. And what it comes down to is there's no meaning in life except the meaning that you create. And, I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense, but when Will Smith says it, you kind of want to believe him. And then Steven Spielberg, I worked for these guys. So maybe that is the meaning of life. It's what you create. And it's expressed in pop culture, in Hollywood culture, through a word that I assume the majority of you will recognize, YOLO. YOLO. You only live once. And they romanticize this version of reality. They romanticize that this is where you get meaning. You only live once. There's no objective meaning. And Miley Cyrus would voice it, it's my life, I can do what I want to. And don't judge me for the fact that I know that lyric. Katy Perry would say, you know, last Friday night I had a party and I'm going to repeat it again. And that's what we're going to do because we're going to party. And I don't care what anybody tells me. Why? Because it's my life. There's no purpose behind it. So I create my own meaning. And as I say that, you can just see the light of the world coming into this venue from behind me. So it's very appropriate. And it's almost a bastard version of Epicureanism. So Epicurus was the guy who said that the meaning of life is just pleasure, hedonism. So if you can have pleasure, then you're okay. That's the meaning of life. And I suppose this works for you if you're a celebrity, if you are young, if you are attractive, and if you are rich. But for the rest of us, I suppose it's a little bit difficult. So yes, Bon Jovi can sing his It's My Life, and I can't really remember the rest of the song, but it's applicable. Sinatra can sing I Did It My Way. But what it ultimately comes down to is this, it is this combination of excessive freedom. There's no meaning behind it. There's no big picture. I create meaning with all of this freedom I have. And hedonism. Eat, drink, and be merry. And then when I look at this worldview played out in YOLO, and I see the amount of selfies that's being taken, and having drinks in trendy bars, or sex, or shopping, and they say, you only live once. Now forgive me for being cynical, but if I look at that, I would say, hardly. Hardly do you live once. Is that a life? That's half a life, if anything. If that is what it comes down to, if you experience your self-fulfillment in that, and you call that you only live once, if that. Now, the intellectuals behind this movement, or the intellectual thinking behind YOLO, they are a little bit more cynical, I suppose. So a guy called Stephen Jay Gould, he's a paleontologist, did I say that correctly, at Harvard University, he said the following. We are here because one odd group of fishes had a peculiar fin anatomy that could transform into legs for terrestrial creatures because the earth never froze entirely during an ice age. Because a small and tenuous species arising in Africa, woohoo, a quarter of a million years ago, has managed so far to survive by hook and by crook, we may yearn for a higher answer, but none exists. So that's the intellectual background to this YOLO movement. It's quite bizarre, as I think it was a Russian writer who said, it's hard to get meaning from that. We are all the descendants of monkeys, so now let's love one another. You know, it doesn't follow. It doesn't follow to get excessive meaning and purpose from a very blind evolutionary view that Stephen Jay Gould just described over there. Tolstoy. Leo Tolstoy, the Russian writer, he went through a crisis. He's just written War and Peace, which is the biggest work in the history of literature, literally the biggest work in the history of literature. And he's reflecting on life. He's a success by most people's standards. He says the following, today or tomorrow, sickness and death will come. They had come already to those I love or to me. Nothing will remain but stench and worms. Sooner or later, my affairs, whatever they may be, will be forgotten and I shall not exist. Then why go on making any effort? How can man fail to see this? And how go on living? That is what is surprising. One can only live while one is intoxicated with life. YOLO. As soon as one is sober, it is impossible not to see that it is all a mere fraud and a stupid fraud. That is precisely what it is. There is nothing either amusing or witty about it. It is precisely cruel and stupid. Let me just stop there. So all the romanticized versions that we get, you only live once, you only have one life, live it, drink it up. He's saying, we can talk about that, but it's a mere stupid fraud. It's not even amusing or witty. It's cruel and stupid. Okay, it goes on. My question was the simplest of questions lying in the soul of every man, from the foolish child to the wisest elder. It was a question without an answer to which one cannot live, as I had found in my experience. It was, what will come of what I am doing today or shall do tomorrow? What will come of my whole life? Differently expressed, the question is, why should I live? Why wish for anything or do anything? It can also be expressed thus, is there any meaning in my life that the inevitable death awaiting me does not destroy? Not necessarily a feel-good quote. But Tolstoy, I think, is expressing the ramifications of the worldview that Stephen Jay Gould just expressed. Now, what's weird is we can say, this is Tolstoy. He's a Russian with a massive beard who lived a while ago, a century ago, and we here in South Africa, we're still quoting him. He's okay. Obviously, he's remembered. He can relax. But in the greater scheme of things, Tolstoy will be forgotten. If this world is just going to burn, it's just a blind process, and somewhere we're going to mess up this earth, as all the environmentalists and Hartmann is telling us, then it's pretty much going to end the same way it began. Then Tolstoy is correct. There's going to be nobody here to remember Tolstoy, or Spielberg, or Will Smith, or all the other YouTube videos that I saw in preparation for this. It's a little bit meaningless. And when we look at that, then to write a massive, beautiful piece of literature like War and Peace or Anna Karenina. It's pretty much the same as just taking a spray can and putting a couple of swear words on the side of the OM building. It amounts to the same thing. To live like Mother Teresa or to live like Hitler, it's actually irrelevant. That's the consequences of this worldview. And there's a couple of you who's either struggling with it or who struggled with it. And I spoke to you guys and you said that, well, that's the implications of my worldview. I got this from Tim Keller, but he said, it's pretty much like we're on the Titanic and it's sinking and we've got 15 minutes left. And he asked this question, if we're all going to die in 15 minutes, does it really matter if you are a hugger or a mugger? Does it really matter if 15 minutes before we go, you either go and hug everybody on the boat, everybody's going to die, or you go around and steal some cash? It's going to end the same way. Even if you take this guy's life savings, he's probably not going to give it to you because in 14 and a half minutes, it's going to end the same for everybody. Now, for some people, the absurdity of what I just described is exhilarating. They love the freedom. And on the cover page of National Geographic at the moment, you've got this picture. It's called the Gender Revolution. And if you look closely, they've got a picture of a group of diverse and attractive people. And basically, they just point and they give all the various genders that you can identify with today. Transgender, trans spirit. I can't really see. Half, none. All these new versions, I told you this a couple of times, but if you go on Facebook in Europe, you've got 54 choices and counting in terms of with which gender are you comfortable with. And this is the ramification, I think, of a world where freedom is everything. Freedom is everything. You cannot tell me what to do. In that Monty Python sketch, they've got this, in The Meaning of Life, they've got this scene where this lady is just giving birth to this kid, and they just grab the baby. It's quite gory, and they put it in this cubicle where it's breathing, what do you call it? Bricas? Incubator. And the mother's just lying there, and she asks, is it a boy or a girl? And they say, well, lady, I think it's too early to expose, to put labels on it, don't you think? How prophetic from them. It's a little bit too early to put labels on this kid, whether it's a boy or girl. There's 50 other options. Sartre, the French philosopher, said, the only thing forbidden is to forbid. And we can see how this worldview is being lived out in our culture today, and we can see how it's becoming more absurd by the day as well. So the secularist understanding, I think this is consistent with the secularist understanding, and you've got this carpe diem mentality, but the reality of it is that there's no objective meaning that lies behind this world. And you can either romanticize it and say, we've got freedom, nobody can tell us who and what we are, and we've got the YOLO mentality, or you can react in the way that Tolstoy and others reacted, saying, this is horrible. This is a horrible vision and view of life. In Auschwitz, the story is told of this. I'm not entirely sure about the backstory, but it's something like this. There are kids chasing a rat or something to eat. And I mean, it's not as if the Nazis were interested in eating the rats. So they managed to get the rat. And when the SS officer managed to get the rat, he just throws it over the fence. And they just managed to catch the rat. It's not as if they were going to do anything with rat. And they asked the question, why? Why did you do that? And the answer came back, in this place, there is no why. In this place, there is no why. And I think, according to the secularist understanding of the meaning of life, in this place called this world, there is no why, at least not objectively. All right, let's move on. It gets a little bit better because according to the Abrahamic faiths, according to the Judaic Christian version of reality, they approach the meaning of life a little bit different. They approach it this way. They would say that there is purpose in this world, there is meaning in this life, because there is a personal God behind this universe, guiding it in a particular direction. There's a personal God behind this world, guiding it in a particular direction. And that automatically gives life meaning. And behind it is this notion that we are called to contribute to this world. We are called to contribute to steering it in this particular direction. Can you see with that version of reality? Now, there's obviously problems because we need to answer the question, why is there meaning in a toddler dying? As Christians, we need to struggle with that question. And it's a difficult one. But at least we've got something to hang on to. At least we've got a framework from which to live a meaningful and a purpose-driven life. Can you imagine why a book, the book Rick Warren wrote, The Purpose-Driven Life, why it took off in that way? I mean, it surprised him and everybody else. Why was this book so popular? It's because people are yearning for purpose, and the world is not necessarily providing them with anything objective. Now, I want to talk to you about calling, because I think calling is fundamental to a purpose-driven life. So, what is calling? When we talk about calling, we say the following. You have to follow Jesus with everything you are, everything you do, and everything you have. Now, what I find weird, or at least intriguing, is the fact that a lot of humanists would also use the word calling. They would also talk about calling. But if there's no caller, who's doing the calling? If you say, it's my calling to be an actor, and I refuse to acknowledge any sort of transcendent reality, and you say it's your calling, who's calling you? I didn't call you to be an actor. Did that person call you to be an actor? Where do you get this idea? And that is I think it's borrowed capital from the Christian tradition. Anyways, let's move on. Now, the church often speaks about calling. And every now and then, we'd get somebody in here who tells you how they audibly heard the voice of God to go into Iraq, and they sell books, and it's amazing to hear those stories. And a lot of you, including me actually, would feel a little bit inferior because we didn't hear an audible calling like that. And maybe some of you can identify with that. There's a lot of testimonies that floats around of people hearing got very strong callings, and there's nothing wrong with those callings. I want to praise God for the callings that those people received. But what happens also is that the expectation or the experience of the minority becomes the expectation of the majority. Does that make sense? So that happened to that guy. We all sit as sheep listening to this guy's amazing life story. And I'm not saying that facetiously. And then, you know what? I'm an accountant. I'm not an accountant, but I think you can guess who is. Or I'm a lawyer, so I don't pick on the accountants. Or I'm a teacher. Or I'm doing something basic, if I can say that. And it feels as if you want to really have a calling to live for God. It needs to be something special. You need to hear this massive voice and then go into Iraq or someplace that nobody else wants to go. And that's something I think the church has to answer for. Let me tell you why I think this happened. In church history, there was a guy called Eusebius of Caesarea. Not Eusebius, the 702 talk shows, but Eusebius of Caesarea. And he said that you've got God's will, God's perfect will, and his permitted will. His perfect will is what he called full-time Christian service, what I do, God's perfect will. You guys must listen very carefully. Priests, nuns, Johann, the stuff that we do. Perfect will. And then there's God's permitted will. And that's what you guys do. Permitted will, ordinary stuff, daily things like engineering, or the Greeks would say everything that's not pure, that's not in the world of ideas, that's what you guys are busy with. the perfect world and the permitted world. And Augustine added to that, and he looked at the story of Martha and Mary, and he said, Martha is the ideal one. Why? Because she contemplated. She studied the Lord. While Martha, who was in the kitchen, she was the bad one because she wanted to do stuff. She wanted to cook and serve in that way. And this resulted in a very low view of work. And it's a shame. It still happens in this country. And apartheid happened in South Africa, and we again glorified everything that is within the church, so much so that you had dominees, and even the dominee's wife, who's like 24 years old, is called Mevrou Dominee, because they are so special. They are part of God's perfect will. But moving on. In the Reformation, guys like Luther and Calvin at least restored the dignity of work. So much so that out of that Reformation, stuff like capitalism happened. Now, you can say what you want about capitalism, but at least what they did is they said, no, there's dignity in work. There was a thing called work before mankind fell into sin. You worked in the garden. They said stuff like, you don't work to eat. You eat so that you can work. There's something holy in it. There's dignity in it. Vocation, we would often say, you know, what is my vocational calling? In other words, what should I do? But that's a nonsensical statement. Vocation comes from the Latin vocare, which is to call. So you're basically saying, what is my calling? So your vocation, what you do, is your calling. And that is special, and I think there's a lot of meaning attached to that. So work received dignity again, because the emphasis fell on the biblical understanding of work, which is a good thing, and it was a necessary revolution. And just by the way, if we are called to be followers of Christ, and I go into full-time Christian service, then what are you guys? Are you part-time Christians? In as much as you call yourself a Christian, I'm not assuming that, but in as much as you call yourself a Christian, are you part-time Christians? So Jesus had full-time disciples and part-time disciples. Can you see how problematic that is? So that is something that needs to disappear from our language, this whole notion of full-time and part-time. Now, I want to unpack calling just a little bit. There is such a thing as a primary calling and a secondary calling. Now, what's the primary calling? Some of you might say, you know, you really don't know that what you're doing in life really means something, and you're not sure that that's your calling. And, you know, at the moment, I'm without a calling because I'm not sure what I should do. Nonsense. Inasmuch as you call yourself a Christian, you have a primary calling. Even if you have no idea what to study or what to do in terms of your occupation. And your primary calling is this. You are called to Jesus. We are firstly not called to something, but to someone. Does that make sense? Primarily, you're not called to be an accountant or called to be a pastor or called to be an engineer. You are primarily, first and foremost, called to a person. You're called to the person of Christ. That's the first thing that we need to remember. And when you are called to Christ, there are certain things that you need to do, such as you have to love your enemies. You are called to love your enemies. You are called to forgive. You are called to be a peacemaker. You are called to be a lover of truth. You are called to be holy as Jesus is holy. You are called to not be easily angered. You are called to not always be the victim. You are called to not be selfish, to serve, to be kind, to have compassion, to be humble. You are called to be a good son. You are called to be a good daughter. You are called to be a good husband, a good dad. You are called for all of those roles. Don't think that they are without calling. So if any of you who call yourselves Christians say, you know what, you haven't discovered your calling yet, then I can end the suspense and tell you what's your primary calling. It's follow Jesus. That's the primary one. Now, when it comes to your 9-to-5, I want to say this, that it needn't be your passion for you to also give it unto God. So even if your 9-to-5 is not something that excites you at the moment, you can still do it as if unto God. Now, I'm going to steal this. Madnell told me this example Saturday night, and I think it's beautiful. So if you are not excited about your life at the moment, or what you do, your occupation, and you think that, how is it possible for me to do admin and glorify God? How's it possible to do that? Now, we've got one or two or three parents here. when these kids play, and they are not even thinking of their parents, and they play. They're on the place that they play with their stuff that they play with. And then the parents would just look at them, and they would find so much pleasure out of looking at them. But it's not as if those kids are thinking, I really want to make dad proud. I'm going to put that block over there. That's not what's going on in their mind. But if you understand the fatherly love of God, he's enjoying it. He's enjoying watching you play, watching you do admin. Even if it's a kid contemplating, what should I do now? There's a toy over there and there's something over there and I don't know what to do. In the same way that parents can enjoy that conflict that's going on, I think it's reasonable to say that God takes pleasure out of it. So can you see how you can do stuff unto the glory of God, even if it's not your passion, from that fatherly perspective? That's the one side of it. But I want to say this about individual calling. It is worse to do nothing than to be in the wrong job. Does it make sense? It's worse to do nothing than to be in the wrong job. A lot of people, because we've got delusions of grandeur, we watch too much television. You know, that's what I need to do. I need to be an actor. And then I cannot be a waiter. And for the last 50 years, I believe I can be an actor. And you refuse to accept anything else. I think it's worse to not work than to be in the wrong type of job. And that's important to note. Proverbs say that you must do whatever your hands find to do. Now, to identify your calling in life is not something that I want to diminish and say, just keep doing what you're doing. Because there are certain guidelines. The passion that you have, the skills that you have, the resources and the opportunities that you have, all of these things need to be utilized to determine your calling. And sometimes it's going to mean that you have to take a vulnerable decision, a step in faith to reach your calling. And it's something that you need to pray about. It's something that you need to be intentional about and talk to your friends and parents or mentor figures in your life. And I think if we spend more time seeking that, we'll find a lot of meaning in it. But even if that is not so clear, you are still called. You can still graft, you can still go on, even if it's not spectacular. You know, for the majority of us, they are probably never going to make a movie about our lives. And I know it's hard to accept, and some of you might argue with that. But our calling is not going to be that special. But we can go on with it. I want to backtrack a little bit, and I want to share a story of William Wilberforce. So if we think of this holy and secular dualism, William Wilberforce is the Member of Parliament in England who abolished slavery. And when he came to faith, he was a womanizer, a drunk, he was a YOLO kind of guy. And he was a Member of Parliament because in those days you were able to do that and be YOLO. Well, I mean, I suppose you can do it today as well. And he came to faith and he met with a guy called John Newton. John Newton was a slave trader who came to faith, left the slave trade, became a minister and wrote the famous hymn, Amazing Grace. And whilst Wilberforce was speaking to him, he said, John, I cannot go on with this secular job. I came to faith. I want to dedicate all of my life to Christ, and I want to become a minister. I want to study for the ministry. And John Newton said, for the love of God, don't. For the love of God, don't. Which is a weird thing when somebody comes to you and say, I want to study to be a pastor. And somebody says, for the love of God, don't. Don't do it. But that's what he said. He said, be where you are, as in politics, in the secular, so-called filthy world. That's where you can change things. And he became probably one of the most influential people that this world has ever seen. Probably the biggest reformer. So I wanted to say that just to indicate that if you feel that you've got a special calling and you really want to serve the Lord and you think that you need to do it in so-called full-time Christian service, then that's an ahistorical thing to say. Coming back to my point of our calling, it might be insignificant or it might feel insignificant to just do the admin. But you know what I discovered recently? It's even admin. You know where that word comes from? Ad means to, it's from the Latin, and min, ministry, to the ministry. Who thought that when they were doing ministry, admin, they were doing it for the ministry? That is quite bizarre. But even those things that we do makes a contribution to the bigger game plan of God. Now in Hebrews 11, I'm going to read you a couple of passages from it. If we can get it there on the screen. Now, without faith, it is impossible to please God. For the one who draws near to him must believe that he exists and rewards those who seek him. By faith, Abram, when he was called, obeyed and went out to a place he was going to receive as an inheritance. He went out not knowing where he was going. By faith, he stayed as a foreigner in the land of promise, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, co-heirs of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. These all died in faith without having received the promises, but they saw them from a distance, greeted them, and confessed that they were foreigners and temporary residents on this earth. Let's just keep it there. Abraham was called, and he did something. He moved to a different place. Moses called. All of these Old Testament figures, they took a couple of steps. But how annoying it must have been to not see the bigger picture. But this is what Hebrews 11 tells us. If you submit your life to God and you work for his kingdom, for the new Jerusalem, the city whose architect and builder is God, if you are a part of that, then you can look over the horizon and realize that you are contributing. You are contributing to that place. And that is why the only thing that we can do is to do something in faith and trust God that somebody else will come along and just take it one step further. And one day, when we look at this canvas that is the new earth, we'll see, there's my contribution over there. I'm not sure if you've, well, all of you, I assume, have seen these photos where there's a photo that you can see, you can make it out. So it's a picture of somebody. But when you go closer, you can see it's made up out of lots of smaller photos. I think they call it mosaically. Do you know what I'm talking about? There's at least a few. But let's say there's this photo of the new Jerusalem, the new heavens and the new earth. What Hebrews 11 is saying is that everything that we do, every call that we take in response to God, and we act in faith, one day we'll see the part that we played. Now that's meaning, guys. That's meaning. It's not a world that's going to end. It's going to be torched up. And whether you were Hitler or Mother Teresa, it doesn't matter. Nobody's going to remember. It's not that. So, in closing, I want to say this. You need to work. You need to love. You need to live in faith. The Christian worldview provides us with a picture of meaning, which is both emotionally and intellectually satisfying. And I don't think the other worldviews are able to do that. Meaning, our meaning can be found in responding to the call of a personal God. And the other point that I wanted to make in this talk is we all have a collective calling and we all should seek our individual calling. And in the process of faith, taking one step, just doing what's in front of us, build towards God's plan of renewing, rebuilding the heavens and the earth. Let's pray. Lord, I want to thank you for the assurance that our labor is not in vain. I want to thank you for the fact, Lord, that we are not the products of a blind process. We are not just an accident caught up in space on a speck of dust that we call Earth. Thank you that somebody's watching, that somebody's steering, that there's a personal God behind all of this, and that the good that we do is not in vain. And Lord, there are people here who are unsure about what they need to do specifically, and I pray that you will reveal it to them, but also assure us that we've got a calling, a primary calling, which is to follow you, to become more like you, even if we are unsatisfied in our current occupation. But Lord, we want to be kingdom builders. We want to contribute to that world. And I pray that you make it clear for us, and that you motivate us through faith, that we can see that even if it feels as if we are just pushing a rock up a hill, that it is meaningful and that you can use it. Use our small contributions for your greater kingdom. We pray that in your precious name, in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen. Okie dokie. So you guys are welcome to ask questions. Yaku, you are welcome to walk around. And David didn't hesitate at all. If you guys are hot, I completely understand it, but please go get something cold to drink, or even go stand outside. Nobody's going to take offense if you do it. Yes, David.
I think it's preacher in English. There's written that, okay, alles is een gejaag.
Ecclesiastes.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Ja, alles is betekenisloos, alles gejaag naar wind, so. Sit terug, lach, geniet jou lewe. Was hy net baie depressed of mis ek die betekenis?
So what I find interesting is that a lot of people who are, let's say, antagonists to the faith, they would use scripture to say, how can you believe in this? And you get that from Muslims and atheists and everybody. Now, what I find very interesting is that whenever somebody makes a profound, strong objection, like the new atheist against faith, there's almost no objection that you can find in popular culture that's not already in the Bible. Okay? The Bible asks these penetrating, hard questions. And Ecclesiastes writes his letter from a perspective of meaninglessness in a world where God does not exist. So he's got that Epicurean mentality where he says, it's all meaningless. But you must read the entire book, and then you'll see in the context, ultimately he derives at meaning. Or is it derive or arrive? Arrive at meaning. But the point of that whole book is it's written from a place of meaninglessness, and he's entirely correct. In the same way that Tolstoy wrote what he wrote, because he imagined a life in which God does not exist, but Tolstoy was a very committed follower of Jesus, but he was able to write it because he lived himself into that world. I do not know enough about Ecclesiastes, so if anybody wants to jump in there, they are more than welcome. But I think, as a whole, if we take that approach, then you'll find some dodgy things in Psalms, bashing the enemy's babies against rocks. But I think the wider context is very crucial. Yes, Herman.
So I'm not an expert on Ecclesiastes, but I saw an interesting video recently from the Bible Project. I'll send you the link. And the explanation makes sense to me. He says, the guy in the video says, Ecclesiastes has two characters, not just one, right? So there's someone interviewing the preacher, the critic, and at the end, so you have two voices. You have the one guy saying this is an interview, and then he says what the guy says, and at the end he comments on what this guy says. But it's part of the larger wisdom tradition in the Bible, so Proverbs is also, and then Proverbs is a lot more positive about if you live a good life and you are righteous, then God will reward you. And then there's Ecclesiastes, which says, well, the race is not to the swift. The battle isn't to the strong. No, there's time and chance. And then there's Job as well. And so if you read in the context, I'll send you the video. It's actually pretty cool. But he does temper the idea, and he reminds us of our death and that kind of thing, which is an important part of living the wise life.
Ecclesiastes ends this way: fear God and keep His commands, because this is for all humanity. For God will bring every act to judgment, including every hidden thing, whether good or evil. So he also frames all of his nihilistic sayings with that. But it's a good idea. What's it, the Bible Project? Yeah, they've got short introductions to all the books. It's very helpful. Yeah.
Ravi Zacharias says the phrase "under the sun" is a very important phrase in Proverbs, saying everything is meaningless under the sun. And so without God, there's no real meaning.
Ecclesiastes, right?
For Ecclesiastes, yes.
Okay.
Just quickly, I think the world is very good in answering how questions, but not very good in why. Mm. So here's someone asks, why should we do this? And they say, well, here's 5 points how to have better coffee or something like that. From your talk, what I understand is, so we find meaning in life in work. Can you summarize what you said, please?
Yeah, sure.
No offense, but...
Yeah. So, that's not what I wanted to say. I wanted to say, but thanks for the opportunity to clarify that. We find the meaning of life and purpose in life in the fact that there's a personal God behind this universe, steering it in a particular direction. And the way that we contribute to steering it in a particular direction is not only with work, but also with work. So our primary calling is to love, to serve, to be humble, and all those things, whether in the capacity of being a father or in the capacity of being a husband or a citizen of South Africa or in the workplace, contributes to that. So there's a primary calling. It's collective and it's all-encompassing. And the meaning of life is in that. Now, the reason, or at least because God has a purpose for life, because it's going in a particular direction, it means that He calls us to play different roles in that. And that's immediately personal. It's not this impersonal thing where I feel like I'm going to do that. It's personal. And work contributes in that process. But work is only a part of the secondary calling. It's not the whole thing. And to even take it a step further back, there's meaning in life because God created it that way. That's why there's meaning in life, because God created it that way. And that's why it is in opposition to a secular worldview and an Eastern worldview of reality where there's no personal force behind it. I hope that clarifies it a little bit. Maybe give me some feedback.
There's some people who just can't work. So you're a vegetable or you're verstandelijk gestreemd. So you can't help me. But there's still meaning in life.
Yeah.
Simply because God created it that way. So I just wanted to emphasize focused that. A lot on the work. I just wanted to make sure about the underpinning of the work.
Well, that's where the image of that your girlfriend graciously gave us, in terms of the fact that even if we play, even if we do the silly things, God takes delight in it, in His father nature. It's an important distinction. But thanks for being able to clarify that. Yes, Lorraine.
So I think maybe the missing link is just and you pointed to a little bit, is the kingdom of God that the Bible points to the whole time that's being created, that will eventually happen, and we are part of making that happen. Let the kingdom come. So Jesus is the whole time, proclaim that the kingdom is coming. And And in not sinning and in loving others and in being Jesus to others, we are helping that kingdom come. And that is something that even a vegetable can do. You know, you even if you...
Maybe we should get a different word.
It was Derek's word. But, I mean, never mind that. Even if you your dream, you thought your calling, like I thought my calling was to go to New York and be this, you know, very impressive artist, and that didn't happen. And just evangelizing and loving people is much less glamorous, but it's something that's available to everybody. So even if you are I used to think that if you're a Christian, one of the bonuses that you get is to have your potential fulfilled and your dreams come true kind of thing. And then somebody said to me, but what about the poor lady in Angola, whatever, that's just trying to feed her children? Are you going to say the same thing to her? Like, the bigger you can dream, that's what God's going to give you. You know, it's unrealistic. So even she and even the guy who's at the old age home or whatever has access to being Jesus to other people, loving other people and being kind and building to the kingdom in that way, you know, fighting the enemy in his actions, even in his thoughts, you know. So it's such a non-racist, open to everybody meaning. It's available to all of us.
Well, I think what... Derek, thanks for the emphasis, because there are two things here. One is that life, because there's a God, a personal God behind it, then a person's life has dignity and meaning because God gave it dignity and meaning. That is his ontological status, is who he is. There's no doubt about it. But on top of it, this world is also going somewhere. So part of this personal God who's behind this world is also steering it in a particular direction. And there's it's definitely part of finding meaning is being a part of that calling process. Yeah.
There is another way to interpret that, well, verse that I was talking about. I see it as... the guy trying to tell us not to take things so seriously. The work will never stop. You know, also take time to enjoy life. Also take time just to be happy. I think that's a worthwhile meaning.
Mm. Absolutely. There's an AFCON game. That's why they're so excited. Not because of what you said, David. But it puts it in perspective, right? In the same way that Jesus says... Don't worry about the things of tomorrow. You know, I've got it. There's something in that as well. So I think you're right. I don't think it's a problematic interpretation.